Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we'll be running through the week's security news with Adam Boileau, then diving right on into a sponsor interview with Lauren Pearl of Trail of Bits. She's joining us to talk about something Trail of Bits have been up to lately, adding features to open source software and auditing open source software on behalf of its customers. It is interesting stuff coming up later. I do have a feature interview this week, but it's a long one, so I'll be breaking that out into a separate podcast. It's a great chat with Bob Lord, the CISO for the Democratic National Committee. The guy who hid the server is what I'm going to call Bob from now on. I will publish that one in a couple of days. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, a court reporter for the Melbourne newspaper The Age, stumbled on this yarn, which is just quite funny, actually.
Yes, according to the reporting in The Age, a Melbourne teenager, 16-year-old kid, broke into Apple, apparently breached their, quote, mainframe, unquote, using, I'm sure, all manner of awesome mainframe hacking techniques, breached their mainframe and stole as many as 90 gigabytes of, quote, secure files and accessed customer accounts. The reporting around this hasn't been super clear as to actually what happened.
Because everyone's following up a court reporter's write-up, right? Like, that's why this is. It's very clear to me, you know.
And Apple, of course, have come out and said that, nothing really bad happened and, the kid was up to something, but there's no specifics. It's just we shouldn't worry about the customer accounts bit, although we don't really know anything more detailed than other than the fact that the kid in question stored all of his ill-gotten wares and other hacking instructions in a folder on his computer called Hacky Hack Hack.
Yes, which is obviously a dream headline, as we've seen demonstrated over the last few days. But of course, it is funny, right? Like they're talking about mainframes, they're talking about secure files. What is a secure file, Adam? And if it's on a teenager's hard drive, is it really a secure file?
Apparently he was developing computerized tunnels, quote unquote.
Ah, there you go, of course. Yes. But, of course, this is a minor, right? So we're talking about a juvenile offender here, so the name isn't published, which of course makes it very difficult for technology journalists located in other countries to do any sort of meaningful follow-up to this. But I think the TLDR is some kid got some stuff out of Apple that he shouldn't have. And thankfully, he's going through the Australian court system and not facing extradition to the US by the looks of things. Although, if I were him, I wouldn't be taking any vacations to Disneyland anytime soon.
Yeah, maybe not so much on that. And also his plans, his dreams of working at Apple, maybe he's going to have to give that a few years before they, forget about exactly what he did.
Yeah, he described himself as a huge fan of Apple. I sincerely doubt this kid will get a custodial sentence because that's just not the way it works here. In fact, prosecutors and even the Australian Federal Police are often quite reluctant to send people like this to prisons, which they refer to as crime universities because they don't want organized criminals getting their hooks into kids who know computers, right? Which seems like a reasonably sensible strategy for keeping the peace. Now, look, we've got some late-breaking news here. Facebook has just nuked several hundred, like something like 650 accounts and pages. They've scrubbed them from their platform. These were apparently misinformation and disinformation accounts being run by Iranian and Russian intelligence agencies, by the looks of things.
Yes, acting on a tip-off from FireEye's intelligence unit about this group. People are calling it like Liberty Front Press on the basis of the name of one of the kind of fake news organizations they're hiding behind. It looks like an Iranian influence operation, promoting Iranian interests in the Middle East and in the US and around the place with a bunch of fake content both on and off the Facebook platform. Facebook's taken out a bunch of the stuff that FireEye kind of identified and pulled the threads on. It's obviously not the, by far from the first example of, inauthentic news, I think is the term that FireEye are using to cover this, that we've seen. But the Iranian operations obviously aren't just focused on the US. There's all sorts of areas around the world that they're attempting to promote their interests and promote their agenda.
Some pretty interesting analysis kicking around on this, and a lot of people saying that it looks from this operation like they're really experimenting and refining their tactics. So we can definitely expect to see more of this in the future. Another thing that seems to be coming out of this is that the Iranians' use of this type of use of these techniques is actually a little more advanced than we previously thought.
Yeah, they seem to be, actually even spending real advertising dollars on the platforms as well, which, I guess is,
it's good. One way to extract some shareholder value. Way to go, Facebook. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Apparently $6,000 was their budget for advertising on Instagram and Facebook. So, yes, definitely shareholder value totally enhanced there.
I've seen a few people questioning why Facebook terms this coordinated inauthentic behavior. And I think I've got an answer to that. We did an interview with Alex Stamos at last year's Black Hat after his keynote there. And really what he had to say was that, inauthentic accounts are just a problem that are very easy to deal with because it's just a straight up terms and conditions violation. So you can get rid of them and it's not really about regulating speech or looking at what those accounts are saying. It's just saying, well, this account doesn't belong to a real person. Goodbye. So for those of you wondering why they term it that way, that is why. Now, of course, staying with Facebook, we've got an interesting report here from Reuters, a very interesting report that says Facebook has been instructed to assist authorities in, now it's either extracting some secret end-to-end encrypted messages or actually eavesdropping on some encrypted E2E Facebook Messenger messages. Not quite sure on that, but it looks like there's actually been this battle going on behind the scenes. Now, this is completely distinct from any sort of push by lawmakers to legislate around this. It looks like, depending on the outcome of this, this whole thing might be settled by the US courts.
Yeah, this court case is going on in Fresno County in California between the Department of Justice and Facebook, where it's all sealed at the moment. We don't have a bunch of details, but it's understood that this is in relation to an investigation the DOJ are doing into some MS-13 gang members that are using Facebook Messenger and maybe text messaging, but also voice calling over the top of the Facebook Messenger platform with the crypto in place. And they're looking for ways to intercept messages and to eavesdrop on the call communications.
So this is about live interception, not accessing messages after the fact.
Yeah, it seems like they are interested in a way to wiretap the voice comms being carried out over the platform, I'm assuming, as well as text messaging, which may or may not be at rest somewhere. It's a little bit unclear just because we haven't seen the full details of this. But yeah, obviously, I mean, by comparison to the Apple case, I mean, this one is interesting, because different vendor, slightly different platform, different set of concerns are around how they'd go about implementing this capability if, in fact, they end up being ordered by the court to do so. So it's a little, kind of a different story than the Apple one. But yeah, the fact that this has been going on kind of quietly without getting much fanfare maybe indicates, a willingness to try a slightly different approach.
If I had to guess, someone on the Facebook side leaked this to try to get it out there. And of course, Facebook is arguing, hey, this is end-to-end encrypted. We can't do anything about that. And the government's retort to that is, well, too bad. You're going to have to. And, we've seen this. I watched this several years ago play out in the Brazilian courts. And, of course, they don't have the same sort of authority over a US company. But we saw that many times where the judges in Brazil were saying, no, you have to, you have to comply. And they're saying, well, we can't, and I guess the difference here is the US courts can say, well, we're going to hit you with a big old stick if you don't.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because both sides, fundamentally do have pretty good points. And as you say, there's kind of more at stake here because it's in the US and, because it's not necessarily Apple who've, kind of made their position kind of clear. Maybe Facebook is a, is an easier target in some ways for the DOJ compared to...
Well, they are pushing back on it. They are pushing back on it, right? So, yeah, and I don't even know if we're going to find out about this. I don't know if these procedures will be unsealed at some point. Maybe the lawyers listening can tell us about that. But I just feel like if the courts really push Facebook on that, that there is a chance that there won't be any legislation required in the US. I mean, we're going to just sort of wind up with a bit of a precedent here.
Yeah, well, that would certainly be an interesting outcome, and what effect that would have. I mean, say that is the outcome. Say Facebook are ordered to introduce technical means. What is that? Is the user base going to care? Are we going to see any move away from Facebook owned platforms, or I mean, is everyone just kind of so over being scared of the, you know, of the internet and scared of communications and scared of Intercept that no one cares? I mean, maybe it's not an issue after all. I don't know.
Well, I suspect the people we know will care quite a lot, and I suspect that the 99.9% of the other people in the world really won't.
Yeah, I suspect so. So many poor 90s cypherpunk tears will be wept, and no one else will care.
That's right. Yeah, cheery.
So grim. So grim.
Now, turning our attention to CyberScoop, and this so-called PPD20 has been eliminated. Now, this was a sort of equities process that US military were forced to consider before launching so-called cyber operations. Adam, what can you tell us about PPD20 and what its elimination means?
So Presidential Policy Directive 20, which was introduced by Obama back in 2012, kind of tries to juggle all the various needs of, you know, balancing the impact of offense and defense in the, you know, in cyber operations, and tries to kind of make sure that no one's stepping on anyone's toes whilst they're carrying out offensive cybers. You know, one wants to burn defensive techniques or burn offensive techniques. And yeah, kind of juggles all of those responsibilities in a way that, you know, if you talk to people who have been in the US, you know, I see in the offensive military bits, everyone found kind of onerous, I guess. I mean, because it was a, you know, fairly new, you know, new concept to juggle this, you know, all these kind of competing demands. Anyway, the suggestion now is that this has been, you know, kind of made not a thing by the Trump administration, and, you know, the cybercom and various offensive bits of the US military are kind of a bit more free to, you know, launch cyber operations in their own kind of areas of command without necessarily having to check with anyone else. We talked, I think, what, it was a couple of weeks ago about, you know, some of the example paperwork that got released under the Freedom of Information, you know, which kind of actually was quite sensible. Like, it seemed like a reasonable process to actually think before you go and, you know, dot slash your way into somebody else's stuff. Yeah, that has now been pushed aside. And we don't really know what that's going to mean, you know, whether that's going to mean, you know, sort of uncaging some of the options that, you know, battlefield commanders have a more kind of tactical cyber, I guess, you know, without having to think about big picture. What that's going to mean, we don't really know. I mean, one of the things that people have been saying, we saw what Bobby Chesney on Twitter, you know, talking about the fact that Cybercom and the NSA, by virtue of having the same person in charge of them, naturally kind of deconflict important stuff. I mean, anything that kind of perks up to that level of leadership, you know, is kind of considered by virtue of that role still being one person.
Well, and I thought it was interesting that Bobby pointed that out, right? And it's funny, though, he's quote tweeting General Nakasone, who is, of course, you know, runs NSA, who's recommended keeping Cyber Command and NSA under one leader for at least 2 more years. And it's just funny where you've got, you know, the leader of these two organizations saying, I recommend that I remain leader for the next 2 years. So we'll see if that actually happens, because I know that there's a bit of movement in the US around that. There's obviously people who want to see it as a split role. There's people jostling to be head of Cyber Command as well, from what I understand. So yeah, look, it's an interesting time, but while they've got that dual hat role, you know, there is just a bit of a natural equities process there. But what happens when that role finally does split? Who knows?
Yeah, well, and of course, and the concern is, you know, you end up with, you know, commanders who don't necessarily have a strategic picture making a bunch of choices that may have impacts, you know, well beyond their area of, you know, their area of responsibility. I mean, you can imagine, you know, the fallout from the Israelis firing the Stuxnet when, you know, we didn't really understand what that was going to mean. I mean, that's changed the big picture, you know, of cyber strategy. And, you know, they didn't necessarily have the same degree of control that, you know, the US had on considering big picture stuff. And yeah, maybe we'll see, you know, more fallout, or maybe we'll see, you know, more agile, more effective, less bureaucratic use of, you know, of the cybers for military purposes. And maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
I want to say thanks too to Bobby Chesney, who took me out for tacos and coffee while I was in Austin. We drove around a bunch. It was sort of like an episode of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, but without the comedy. And we talked about cyber instead. But it was actually quite a lot of fun. So thanks again, Bobby. The brisket tacos, man, they were good. Now there's a group of people calling themselves Intrusion Truth, and they're running around doxing Chinese operators, you know, Chinese government operators. Is that the go here? Because this is a story from Joe Cox over at Motherboard.
Yeah, this is a write-up of this group, Intrusion Truth, that have been running like an anonymous WordPress blog site, as you say, doxing various elements of Chinese kind of, you know, cyber intelligence community. We've seen them dox members of APT3, of APT10, and it kind of feels like it's a bunch of, you know, people who work incident response, either in the private sector or in government, you know, kind of going rogue a little bit and dropping some names in places where, you know, normally you wouldn't see them. We don't see the likes of FireEye or CrowdStrike, you know, generally dropping individual names. They might talk about units, they might attribute certain things to, you know, government agencies, but we don't generally see names other than in, you know, indictments from the FBI. And I imagine that probably does rankle a bunch of people who have been able to do this kind of research. So, yeah, the blog has some information that has kind of been borne out in the public record, you know, as time has progressed. I mean, it's been kicking around for, what, like a year or so now. And we've seen some of the names that came up in the most recent indictment kind of match what the blog was saying. So, I mean, there's some kind of – like, their information looks pretty credible, looks pretty good. The motivations, you know, just – to my reading, feel like frustration and a little bit of, well, let's just go name and shame and ruin some few people's lives who are doing bad things.
It's always been amazing to me that, you know, you get so much good information when you start speaking to incident responders at big companies. And I mean, or interesting companies. You go speak to some incident responders at defense contractors, at Google, you know, companies like Google or Facebook or whatever. You know, they've really got some good info there that you would only... The only other people who have insight into those sorts of things, you know, do work for SIGINT agencies. So, and that, you know, of course, private sector incident responders aren't bound by the same constraints as SIGINTers. So that definitely rings true for me. I mean, that sounds plausible.
Yeah, and it's I mean, the question is, you know, are they just releasing information that they found their day jobs in a way that's not attributable to try and push things around, or are, you know, is it a more active campaign? We saw, I think, the most recent set of data they were talking about had, for example, they had like logs of Uber trips of, you know, some Chinese kind of government hackers going to and from work, and they had like the trip data from the Uber account, which means either they breached the Uber account or they breached Uber or, you know, some other way of getting access to that information, which, I mean, the question is, like, is that, was that passive, you know, or do they actually go out and kind of substantiate some of these things themselves, which, you know,
what's,
you know,
a little sneaky shell between friends, right?
Well, exactly. And it's, you know, like, this is the kind of insight normally you only get, you know, at a bar at a hackathon from some incident responders after a few beers kind of thing. And so it's kind of funny seeing that, you know, show up on a blog on the internet and get written up in Motherboard. But yeah, it's an interesting, you know, interesting kind of twist on it. I guess the main thing is I really hope the OPSEC is up
to it.
Well,
I was just about to say, like, chances are at least one person involved in this listens to the show. And, I'm sure I speak for both of us, Adam, when I say, you know, be careful with that.
Yeah. Clearly you know what you're doing. Otherwise you wouldn't have good information. But, you know, if that is you doing it, dear listener, then yeah, be careful.
Yeah, I'd be making sure that your setup is O day proof, right? At that point.
Yeah, like no gambling holidays in Macau. Just, you know. Stay stateside, or, you know, the UK, wherever you happen to be.
Now, in further sort of government spooky SIGINT-y sort of news, Microsoft apparently just took down 6 domains, phishing domains that were being used by APT28 to target US politicians. Certainly seems like Russian SIGINTers are not slowing down, but I can't say I'm surprised by that. I'd be surprised to see more doxing and WikiLeaking at this point, but, you know, just general collection and shells everywhere and spear phishing, not so surprised.
No, I mean, it's good that they're keeping on top of it and keeping the kind of pressure up in terms of talking about this publicly rather than it just kind of, you know, carrying on as business as usual. But yeah, I mean, you're right. There is a certain degree of, like, this is just what happens. SIGINT agencies are going to, you know, in this case, you know, military intelligence agencies are just going to go about doing their business. And if we, you know, kind of push them off, you know, this particular avenue, like running phishing sites and, you know, phishing Republican think tanks and that kind of thing, you know, if we push them off that where we do have visibility of it to a certain extent, then they're going to go find something else that maybe we don't see so well. So yeah, maybe it doesn't need to be made such a song and dance of the whole time.
Yeah, maybe not. But, you know, we live in interesting times. Now, a feature we've been expecting to land for a little while has landed. Gmail has a confidential mode that now lets you send self-destructing emails. Not sure what the uptake is going to be like on this, to be honest, Adam.
Yeah, so this is a feature where, like, you want to send an email, you write your email, you hit a button that says, you know, confidential or disappears after a while or requires a password or a PIN code or whatever to access, and then Google stores the message on its service somewhere and then sends the person basically a link that says, you know, please log into your Google account to read this message. And then you have to auth or, you know, do whatever else. And Google takes care of deleting the messages after the fact, which, you know, for some use cases is probably a reasonable thing for people to have. I mean, it's kind of, in a way, not really fair to call it email anymore because it's not really email.
No,
but, I mean,
it's email enabled messaging, message hosting something. I don't know. What
yeah,
do you call it?
Which, I mean, maybe that's a distinction that only nerds care about. But, I mean, yeah.
I mean, it's important to realize, too, that, you know, my email, I mean, look at everything else. Everything else is web, right? Of all of these protocols, what have we kept? We've kept DNS, we've kept web, and we've kept SMTP, which is horrible. It's a horrible way to communicate with one another. I think Gmail, you know, Google in particular has done a good job of kind of making email usable, right?
Yeah,
but email, by and large, is just such a relic of a bygone era. We even saw Google something like a decade ago try with, you know, Google Wave, right? We're going to replace email with this thing, and it just didn't stick. We're kind of stuck with it. But you just sort of wonder if a feature like this is, you know, the future of business communication. I don't think it is.
No, probably not. And I mean, there's certainly been plenty of criticism in the sense that, you know, training people to click on links and enter their credentials all the time, which, I mean, let's face it, everyone already does anyway. I don't think it necessarily increases the susceptibility to phishing, but, you know, the idea that you can send phishing emails that will get, you know, hosted by Google and then deleted afterwards, which makes forensics hard, like, that seems like a useful thing for an adversary.
It certainly does.
might go ahead and use that one on the job. But, yeah, other than that, I don't know what use, you know, whether I would use it for anything else.
Now, Skype, we spoke about this a while ago, another new feature, Skype private conversations. And now a thing, this gives you E2E text-based messaging. Is that right? Using the Open Whisper Signal protocol.
Yeah, this appears to leverage Signal to add messaging, but also crypto for the voice comms, according to
Oh, really? So you got E2E voice on Skype.
Yeah, that seems to be what it's saying. I mean, you know, I'm not sure anyone actually still uses Skype, but I mean, perhaps people do. And yeah, end-to-end crypto is only, you know, what, 15 years too late for the platform?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Microsoft, and, you know, I'm not too concerned for law enforcement in this case because I'm sure they've engineered it so they can get in the middle of those calls because Microsoft has always been very law enforcement friendly. Although, I don't know, post-Snowden, I don't know if they still are, but you would assume there's an intercept capability.
Well, you would, right? I mean, Skype's been around for so long and been such, you know, been so used by criminals in the past that, I mean, I think the idea that Skype would go dark is not a thing that's acceptable to anyone. We're not seeing any whinging about Skype going dark. So by definition, therefore, Skype has not gone dark.
Yeah, that's it, right? Oh, now you remember these people who were sending around ransom saying, hey, here's your password. They were pulling like people's passwords out of password dumps and saying, we've hacked your password, you know, and we're in your computer and we've recorded a video of you masturbating and you have to pay us Bitcoin or we're going to show the world. Apparently they, you know, just by tracking Bitcoin addresses and stuff, it turns out they got $500,000 by doing that.
Yeah, based on the subset of Bitcoin, you know, wallets that have actually been seen by people doing this research. So yeah, $500,000 is actually pretty good for that scam, I guess. You know, if you want to monetize a password breach, I mean, Troy Hunt, if you're listening, you could be a rich man on the basis of all that password data you've got. If only you had thought of the scam. So. Tut-tut, didn't think of it, unless it's Troy.
Well, you know, he does drive a nice car, lives in a nice house. You know, maybe this is
maybe
the model.
Maybe it was him.
You never know. Apple has apparently done a big cleanup of its Chinese app store, which is interesting. Apparently, you know, just deleting apps by the truckload.
Yeah, apparently some guy went onto the Chinese app store, got himself a lottery applet for his local like municipal lottery system thing, bought himself $17 worth of lottery tickets. Turns out the local lottery doesn't actually sell their tickets online or via an app in the app store. And he like physically walked into Apple's offices in Shanghai and complained. And yes, Apple, I'm not sure whether it's directly as a result of this particular anecdote, but yes, Apple have started to remove lots of fake gambling apps from the app store. And of course, the question I have is, why are they there in the first place, Apple?
That is a valid question. That is a valid question. Of course, they are also removing other apps like VPN and censorship circumnavigation. Apps. So yes, Apple is very used to removing apps from its Chinese app store. Oh, now I've got an interesting item here that I haven't actually seen written up anywhere. I saw this one bouncing around on Twitter. GoDaddy has apparently revoked something like 865 certificates after discovering that there was a bug in their code that allowed people to kind of bypass certain verification steps. So yeah, they've hit the old revocation button, which is kind of useless because, you know, TLS revocation is horrible. But this looks interesting and I'm surprised it hasn't been written up anywhere.
Yeah, it seems like there was a bug in their code that they say was introduced in November 2014 that appears to be some mechanism by which you could bypass the automated domain control validation. So I'm not quite sure exactly which mechanism they're talking about, but you know, there was presumably you could supply a code from another validation process that didn't relate to the domain in question, or there was some other way of bypassing those checks. They issued something like 860 certificates. You know, that involve the bug. They're not quite clear.
Yeah, it's not clear whether they're fraudulent or whether or not someone was just using a verification bypass as part of their workflow, right? Because that's entirely possible as well.
It's a little bit unclear. I mean, there is a couple. Someone actually asked a bit later on in this particular mail thread on the Mozilla Dev Security Policy list, whether or not they had seen any nefarious or seen anything unusual, and the guy from GoDaddy did say they hadn't seen anything nefarious. They have got a list of the domains, or someone's dug a list of the domains out, and none of them look like, you know, I am a Russian phishing site, but, you know, that's kind of the point, I suppose. Russian phishing site.
Yeah, floormasteryorkshire.co.uk doesn't scream SIGINT.
No, so, I mean, it seems like GoDaddy maybe just being a good citizen and complying with their obligations, to the CA, onto the browser manufacturers in terms of being a CA and disclosing the fact that they did screw something up and that they have endeavored to fix it, which is good. It's nice to see that process perhaps working like it's intended to, but yeah, you're
well,
right.
Well, I mean, they can add it to the completely dysfunctional revocation lists, right? So
that
part of the process might be working, but the revocation bit certainly doesn't.
Although what I think is good about this is it does demonstrate the value of the cert transparency issues. I mean, if we didn't have cert transparency everywhere, would people be so, you know, would it be so easy to figure out what's going on? And, you know, would people be so motivated to report? I don't know. So.
Yeah. Good question. Tell us about RDoS.
There's been a bunch of people talking about computational complexity denial of service through regular expressions, which is not a new bug class by any means. I mean, we've seen this kind of, you know, people submitting worst case data or worst case regexes that cause, you know, computation to just kind of run away to web servers. We've seen that going back, you know, probably a decade or more.
It's the smarter person's way to DOS someone, right? Like going application layer instead of just volumetric.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, there's been actually, I saw a really good conference presentation probably 10, 15 years ago about, you know, kind of qualitative denial of service where you walk the site and figure out where you can create most load for least work and use that at application layer to carry denial of service. So same sort of thing, but in this case, using regular expressions. The reason it's kind of come up in the last little while is it does appear that people are using it, and B, the Node.js runtime has a bunch of areas where, you know, it's particularly bad at this kind of thing, and we are starting to see people use it now that Node is more widespread, sadly. We are seeing people start to use it against Node stuff, and, you know, people have been talking about it. So, yeah, it's kind of come back to people's mind. I think there was a talk at Usenix about this is one of the things that's kind of pushed it up in people's consciousness lately.
Yeah, well, hopefully the developer community out there can kind of, you know, have a bit of a look at mitigating this because, yeah, you don't really want someone with a, you know, botnet consisting of 10 compromised D-Link routers being able to take your website offline. That would kind of suck.
Exactly. There's a couple of links to some test examples on GitHub in the show notes if people want to have a look.
There you go. Now, we got a funny one here about some cloud service with an API that actually exposed TLS private keys. Way to go, guys.
Yeah, there's this front-end reverse proxy thing called Trafic. Apparently, if you could talk to its high port management service, you could just ask its API to give
Can I have
the
some
keys,
please? Here you go. Yep, thanks.
Yeah,
bye.
So someone's been rummaging around through Shodan, etc., looking for these and extracting the keys out of them. One of them was funny because someone found one that was front-end proxying some Onion site, which was, you know, good for a bit of cheap lols. But yes, if you're a pen tester and you happen to see Trafic around, make sure you go go steal the private keys and stick it in your report.
There you go. So this is like a bit of vendor kit, is it, that has an API? Like, this isn't some... I thought it was a cloud service.
Look, it's hard to tell in this modern world, but as far as I can read it, it's an open source software package that people use to kind of front end, you know, a bunch of their various cloud stuff. So you've got a bunch of Kubernetes or, you know, a bunch of Docker workers or something. You can bung this in front to kind of do load balancing and reverse proxying. There may well be a cloud one, and it's developed by a cloud company. So, you know, the answer to your question is everything is a cloud these days. Who even knows anymore?
Microsoft's VB script engine 0-day, getting some use, getting some love, Adam.
I'm amazed. Like, who even turns this on anymore? Oh, dear. But no, yes, apparently North Korean hackers, the people who, the particular North Korean crew that hacked a whole bunch of hotels a while ago and then were kind of like owning business people who showed up on the wireless network after they, you know, checked in through their own hotel management system. Anyway, that crew apparently has been shelling people with MS VB script, like browser 0-day, which...
Of course, yeah, Microsoft turned this off by default, but I'm guessing the people who turn it on are people who actually need to use VBScript to render some crappy legacy software.
Which, I mean, I guess is, you know, every giant enterprise ever must have some horrible, you know, written for IE6 internal app that requires it, but just don't browse the internet with that browser, I think, would be my advice to you. But yes, good on them for finding some sweet 0-day in a dead component, so...
Ah, and there's a deserialization bug in WordPress that apparently just hasn't been fixed, Adam.
Yeah, so this was there was a talk about this actually at one of Black Hat or DEF CON, I forget which, and I didn't go to it. But yeah, the deal is that there is a PHP deserialization vulnerability in a particular type of like file stream handler in PHP, the FAR, P-H-A-R format, which is kind of like a PHP archiving thing. Anyway, when those are processed, you can use PHP deserialization to get code execution in. Essentially, anywhere where you can convince PHP to open a file stream using the FAR handler where you control the content, you can and go on and send the code exec. WordPress is one example of an application where you can do this. So it's a little bit unfair to call it a WordPress bug. You know, it's kind of a PHP misfeature.
Does this affect, like, for example, you know, default configurations using PHP?
The write-ups have been, oh my God, it's a WordPress bug. And, you know, whilst you can exploit it through WordPress, the conditions are you need to be able to upload a file and then you have to be able to trigger a read of that file through this particular file handler. And the method that the people who've been talking about it have been using is file upload as an image. So you need to have kind of posting rights to WordPress and then an XML XXE to open a file using the FAR file handler in PHP. So quite a, you know, sweet way of chaining them together, but... Yeah, I mean, you know, for people who run WordPress, the short version is people need kind of posting rights to do this. Or
well, but I mean, anyone who comments on a WordPress blog has posting rights, dude.
Well, and then also is able to trigger it through, in this case, the XML XXE or some other mechanism. So it's a little, it's not every WordPress is going to get owned kind of bug.
But this is a pretty neat attack against, I'm guessing, a whole bunch of applications running PHP.
Yeah, and we've seen other examples against some like PDF generation libraries and a few other bits and pieces. But yeah, I mean, because it's kind of a PHP thing rather than an application thing, but it's quite dependent on how the application works. You know, it's the sort of bug that, you know, we'll see bug bounty people working over for a while and, you know, probably getting some good cash out of. PHP needs to fix it in the FAR file stream processor is kind of my understanding of it. And then, of course, that version, new updated versions of PHP then have to be used everywhere. So, you know, it's one of these very long tail kind of bugs.
I suspect you're right and the bug bounty people are going to be having a good old time with this one. But Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, mate, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat, and I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. So, this week's show is brought to you by Trail of Bits. They're a security consultancy, but they're not a bunch of red teamers. Rather, Trail of Bits is a security engineering firm. They do a lot of code audits, but they do also actually build stuff. Lauren Pearl is head of strategy and operations at Trail of Bits, and she joined me this week to talk about some of the work they're doing around open source software. Trail of Bits has already done a bunch of work on OS query on behalf of Facebook, but beyond that and sort of post that, they're increasingly moving to work on other open source projects on behalf of customers who might want, you know, code audits or additional features added. Here's what Lauren had to say.
So we were introduced to OS Query when Facebook asked us to do some work on it, porting some of the capabilities to a new OS. But currently, we actually bring OS Query in as a tool that we can leverage for other companies to get certain security operation tasks done. So we still collaborate with the Facebook team to make sure we're upstreaming changes that we make to OS Query as a project. We're not necessarily always doing work for Facebook itself. We've expanded the number of clients that can use OS Query as a helpful solution for their companies.
Yeah, now I think the way you put it to me when we were discussing this before we hit the old record button is that really you're just adding features on behalf of your clients, right? Like that seems to be the business model behind your OS Query development these days.
Yeah, so the way we go about it, you can sort of think of it about it as a combination of like a personal shopper and a tailor. So we'll go in, we'll talk about the requirements, understand security goals and needs, and then we'll go out into the open source market and try and find the right open source tool to solve this client's problem. And then we'll take the project. If it needs it, we'll clean it up and make sure that it's secure and works the way it claims to. We'll build new features that can sort of perfectly fit the solution to what the client is looking for. We'll test it with the client, again, confirm. And at the end of the day, when we pass the solution to the client, we'll also try to open source, or rather, we will try to upstream the new code to the open source project so that it's maintained by the overall project instead of having to maintain a fork.
Now, that's a really interesting idea, right? Because it seems so obvious once you say it that there would be a decent business in kind of fixing open source software and making it sort of more, business applicable. I mean, we've seen IBM do that, 15 years ago with a whole bunch of Linux stuff. But I guess delving into more niche projects and, making open source more business friendly. Yeah, I mean, that it seems like you'd get a pretty steady stream of work there. How's that working out for you, for the business?
It works out really well. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why TrailofBits loves doing things open source. Primarily, it really fits in with sort of our mission-driven strategy about pushing the entire security industry forward as opposed to just fixing the same problem over and over again. Most of the employees at TrailofBits are security engineers who really want to focus mainly on the toughest problems in the kinds of work that we do. And so releasing things open source is a way to help us keep our work fresh because we're always solving new problems and then releasing them to the entire industry so that everyone can benefit. We see that there's a huge need and that need's not getting filled, right? So we'll talk to, for example, a lot of consultants who work with companies on a day-to-day basis and they see either places where open source software could be leveraged and it's not, or this happens a lot, we'll see places where companies are using open source software, but that software's not been maintained and now it's a huge security risk. So going in and cleaning that up is definitely something that a lot of companies need, and we think that it's going to be worth it for them to work with us.
Yeah, I mean, I can think of open source software that I use that I know in my heart of hearts is a liability. Unfortunately, I don't have budget to pay for a team of TrailofBits security engineers to go and audit the code. but yeah, no, I know. I certainly know what you mean. So is that mostly what people are asking for, is like cleanups as opposed to new features?
It can run the gamut. It really depends on what people's security needs are. But you mentioned budget, and actually that's an interesting point, because one thing that's really nice that we've done is to create these sort of support groups around certain capabilities. So for example, we have a security operations group where we're working on a couple of different tools and enabling them to work for a couple of different companies. But if companies' needs overlap, you can always pool resources. So it's not like you have to build your own custom solution that only works for you. Your solution will probably work for a couple of other companies. And if enough companies are working on the same things, they pool resources, and it's actually more value for less cost for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, you could find some tool that would have uses with certain, in a certain vertical, and then I guess pass the hat around and say, hey, do you want to kick in some hours into this? And then you get it. You get to use it before it gets kicked upstream. I mean, what's the advantage from the buyer's side to chipping in when it's going to go upstream anyway?
Yeah, there's a variety of reasons. One is that you get to dictate exactly how a tool is improved and the new capabilities that are built. And so you can make sure those capabilities are the ones that your company wants. Another advantage, though, is that if the security for other competitors in your industry is better. You're protecting yourself from the possibility that someone else gets hacked and consumers stop trusting everyone. So for example, if Target gets hacked, is a customer more or less likely to want to give their credit card information to Gap? So it's not necessarily the case that you're going to win if your competition gets hacked.
So it's about, yeah, the rising tide carries all ships, protect the vertical, right?
Exactly. Better security is better for everyone.
So can you give us a couple of examples of projects that you've been contributing to?
Sure. Well, one of our clients really wanted to have better capabilities around whitelisting and blacklisting binaries. And they were interested in using Google Santa to do that, but they didn't really have a good place to fit it into their architecture. So we created an extension actually for OS query that integrated Google Santa so that you could manage endpoint configuration there. In addition to doing that, Google Santa required a little bit of cleaning up and re-engineering. So we went in and did that too. We added support for CMake and fuzzing, and we improved privilege separation as well. And that's a fairly typical way that we do the work.
Now, I understand TrailerBits is also supporting, going all in on supporting SummerCon, which is a conference that's held in New York every year. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so SummerCon has been in New York for the past 10 years, but it's actually one of the longest running security sort of hacker conferences in the world. When it started out, you know, I've been told by Dan, who's been in the industry for a long time, that it started out with 20 hackers in a basement. And this past year, it was 300 attendees sold out. So we really like SummerCon. It's in New York, right in our backyard. It also just does things really right. It has a single track of talks. The talks are highly technical and very interesting. They're really transparent about the way that they accept sponsorship and use that funding to support research. So we had been talking with SummerCon about creating a program that could help us find new emerging talent and support that talent to do interesting projects. And in fact, Trail of Bits has been doing this kind of activity for a while through our internship program. So we'll give funds to folks who are still in college who want to do cool research work. We'll give them the funds to do that, and then we'll give them a mentor from Trail of Bits to lead them through that research, and often a venue to then speak about the research they did and the findings. And so partnering with SummerCon let us kind of blow that project up and offer way more funding and way more chances for that emerging talent.
And what is your support of SummerCon actually look like?
Yeah, so we're giving them $100,000 in grant funding. The funding will go to researchers. So each of the participants will receive $10,000 in grant funding to research the topic of their choice. They'll get mentorship both from Trail of Bits and from the SummerCon Foundation during that research. And then at the end of the time, they'll have an invitation to present their findings at SummerCon after the fellowship. If anyone wants to participate in this fellowship, they can look out for a call for proposals that's going to be coming within the next month. We're hoping to pick all of the fellows by Thanksgiving.
Now, one of the ideas behind this too is that you want to help people from different types of backgrounds get involved. Maybe not just not just white dudes. Not that there's anything wrong with white dudes. I am a white dude, but maybe try to inject a little bit more diversity into that con. Is that right?
Sure. Yeah. So we realized we could do a lot of good in a couple of different ways. We wanted to capture this emerging talent in the security industry and get them interested. But we realized we could set parameters for ourselves so that we were including everybody in that opportunity and pushing ourselves to find that talent outside of the scope of what we might normally look for.
Excellent. All right. Well, Lauren Pearl, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about all of that, about the open source stuff, and of course, this grant program for next year's SummerCon, because I understand this year's has already been. It's been a lot of fun. Cheers.
Thanks.
That was Lauren Pearl of Trail of Bits there. Big thanks to her for that. And of course, big thanks to Trail of Bits for sponsoring the Risky Business Podcast this week. I'll be back in a few days with my interview with Bob Lord, CISO of the Democratic National Committee. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.